All right. Okay. Good morning. The title for this talk is When the Gods Are Changing. It comes from James Michener's novel, Hawaii, which I read several decades ago. In the novel, there's a scene where Abner Hale, the head of a group of missionaries sent to Hawaii from America, is negotiating with the chief and head kahuna, kahuna means priest, Kilolo is his name, about how to situate the new church building on the land the chief has set aside for it. Abner has placed a stone where he is saying the door of the church will go. Kilolo stopped, thought a moment, and then placed his right foot on the stone, indicating the door to Abner's church. Makua Hale, we are in the time when gods are changing. These are always difficult times. When I argue as a kahuna, I am not defending the old gods of Hawaii. They have already been defeated by your god. We all know that. But I am speaking as the kahuna who knows this land. I have often spoken with the spirits of Lahaina, and I understand the hills. Makua Hale, believe me while I tell you that this door is wrong for this land. We will build the door here, Abner said resolutely. So, those of you who have read the novel may recall that they went ahead and built the church as Abner wanted it, a New England-style church that works well in the climate of northeastern United States, but not so well in Hawaii. The church is hot and uncomfortable, but they persevere. It's destroyed once and rebuilt again along the same lines, and then some years later, a whistling windstorm levels the church again. And after that, the people get together and build a new church the way it should have been in the first place, and that stone church, Michener says, stood for more than a century. Michener's account of the culture clash is fascinating, and we see stubborn resistance on both sides of the divide. But I've always been struck by the acceptance of the gods changing and the chief knowing enough about it to say that these times are always difficult. It's an interesting example of what is sometimes called a paradigm shift, and I'll come back to this. The topic first came up for me out of a discussion we had in our queer cohort group a few months back. And one thing I love about that group is that there are a number of different interesting folks who join a core group of us each month. I have deliberately used the term queer to be inclusive and avoid the alphabet soup that's so often employed, which still leaves out many who challenge the heteronormative paradigm in some way. One thing the group discussion uncovered for me was some clear generational differences in how we see things, especially transgender issues. It got me thinking about an online friend of mine who was doing diatribes on Facebook some years back about the evils of transgender. This mystified me because the woman is a lesbian, and I figured that if anyone can understand oppression around sexism and related issues, it should be lesbians. But finally, she wrote a post explaining that she really misses butch women. Ah, somehow that becomes more clear. She's living in a past paradigm, and she fears that girls who start down a road towards recognizing a tendency towards living a more butch life will now get surgery and hormones and turn into men, which is not what she wants. Now, there are several problems with this line of thinking, but what I noticed especially was the overall resistance to a paradigm shift in the queer community. Our discussion in the queer cohort was similar in showing a very similar resistance. Those of us over 50 had more difficulty relating to some of what we are seeing with the younger folks. Not an unusual dynamic. As is true for many of us of a certain age, though, we can look back on several different lives lived in different ways. The technological shifts alone have had profound effects on how we all live our lives. For example, the shift from analog to digital affects how we tell time, how we take pictures, how we talk to each other, remotely or otherwise, and so forth. Other cultural shifts may also occur to you. In the lesbian community, when I came out, we were transitioning away from a butch-femme paradigm into a mandate for everyone to be androgynous. That is, to embody both male and female characteristics, rights, and behaviors. The feminist movement was proclaiming that copying the patriarchal pattern of gender roles was buying into female oppression, and we all needed to be both, all equal with each other. So we all tried to do that for a while. The problem was that even I could recognize butch and femme characteristics in others that didn't seem to conform to the androgyny paradigm and didn't seem to be sort of made up. And yet, I was clear that I wanted a woman, not a man, for my intimate relationships. I remember trying to explain to a woman visiting from Spain who wanted to know what butch meant. I did my best in English, and she replied in Spanish, basically saying, "So you are meaning a woman who is more like a man?" Well, not exactly. But I couldn't figure out a better way to say it. So as I tried to explain it to myself by recognizing that there were differences among classification systems, male and female, masculine and feminine, butch, femme, those who try to make all of these the same are missing some important nuances in how things actually work for real people. Also, all of these so-called opposites are more of a continuum than merely opposites. In my own long-term relationship, my partner was recognizably more butch and I was more femme, and yet we both had many aspects of each. So it has always been confusing. These days, more people are open about being transgender, and they make medical decisions to reinforce that. Many of these folks don't want to be seen as completely one or the other, but non-binary. So we have gender fluid, a way of acknowledging that some of us don't see these divisions as hard and fast, nor as one or the other. It's a way of trying not to be labeled, not put into a box. This has allowed me personally to see my relatively small aspects of gender nonconformity in new ways. And I appreciate the insights. I confess to still struggling with pronouns. As a lesbian with these small rebellions of gender conformity, I've always been indifferent to how people addressed me or referred to me. The hairstyle I have adopted as a priest has only accentuated that. I've been called sir more times than I can count. These days, and I don't care, but these days, trans folks feel insulted by being misgendered. It's right up there with other microaggressions that trigger suffering. So I hear this, and I listen carefully, and I do my best to understand and adjust. I think of my online friend and internally tell her, "Oh, honey, that was the old paradigm, and now we need to adjust to a new paradigm. The young people have moved on and are doing their thing. There are echoes of androgyny, but it isn't really the same. It is a different time now. None of this means that I have to do what those around me are doing, but I do have to make room for it and allow it to inform me." Now I want to shift a little bit to the structure of scientific revolutions. This is a 50-year-old book by Thomas Kuhn, Structure of Scientific Revolutions. He points out that too often science is presented as facts, finished scientific achievements. This is what he calls normal science, or a paradigm. In this book, he looks at the process that happens and the structure of how it happens. He talks about the role in scientific research of what he learned to call paradigms. These are, quote, "universally recognized scientific achievements that for a time provide model problems and solutions for a community of practitioners," end quote. He points out that new ways of thinking need to be based on current paradigms. That is, you can gather a lot of unrelated data, but it is meaningless. You have to have a way to focus it. You need a question. And the question comes from something already known. There's also a legitimate need to refine and clarify an already developed theory, and this just adds to what makes it hard to decide where and when and by whom a particular new law or set of theories happened. At some point, the paradigm shifts, but it's not always clear what that point is or whom to credit. It's messy. So I'm going to read a little bit from this book. It's an academic book, so it's interesting, but let's see what we can do with it. When examining normal science, we will want to finally describe that research as a strenuous and devoted attempt to force nature into the conceptual boxes supplied by professional education. Simultaneously, we wonder whether research could proceed without such boxes. Normal science, the activity in which most scientists inevitably spend almost all their time, is predicated on the assumption that the scientific community knows what the world is like. Much of the success of the enterprise derives from the community's willingness to defend that assumption, if necessary, at considerable cost. Normal science, for example, often suppresses fundamental novelties because they are necessarily subversive of its basic commitments. Nevertheless, so long as those commitments retain an element of the arbitrary, the very nature of research, normal research, ensures that novelty shall not be suppressed for very long. Sometimes a normal problem, one that ought to be solvable by known rules and procedures, resists the reiterated onslaught of the ablest members of the group within whose competence it falls. On other occasions, a piece of equipment designed and constructed for the purpose of normal research fails to perform in the anticipated manner, revealing an anomaly that cannot, despite repeated effort, be aligned with professional expectation. In these and other ways besides, normal science repeatedly goes astray. And when it does, that is, when the profession, or the profession can no longer evade anomalies that subvert the existing tradition of scientific practice, then begins the extraordinary investigation that leads the profession at last to a new series, a new set of commitments, a new basis for the practice of science. The extraordinary episodes in which that shift of professional commitments occurs are the ones known in this essay as scientific revolutions. They are the tradition-shattering complements to the tradition-bound activity of normal science. So this is kind of heavy going, but you get the idea that it's not a simple thing. And I want to do one more little excerpt here that's kind of, I find, interesting. The new theory implies a change in the rules governing the prior practice of normal science. Inevitably, therefore, it reflects on much scientific work they have already successfully completed. That is why a new theory, however special its range of application, is seldom or never just an increment to what's already known. Its assimilation requires the reconstruction of the prior theory and the reevaluation of prior fact, an intrinsically revolutionary process that is seldom completed by a single man or person and never overnight. No wonder historians have had difficulty in dating precisely this extended process that their vocabulary impels them to view as an isolated event. Anyway, it goes on. It's pretty interesting. I find it's a pretty interesting book that really delves into particular situations and really goes into them quite a bit. But I like the way he lays this out, and I think this is true for any kind of a paradigm shift. It's easy to say, oh, it's only one thing, but maybe not. I have one more thing that I found that's not quite so academic. There's a lot of ways to think about the process. We use words like change, transition, transformation, translation, and enlightenment. And I found this essay by John Sansomer in the fall 2025 issue of Primary Point magazine. And he's discussing climate change. It's something that he's worked on a lot. He says, change greets us daily from every direction. We recognize change by how much we work to deny it. We fix, clean, replace, heal, or grow things just to keep our world from changing too far or too fast. But even if our little corner stays reasonably still, the larger world sometimes engulfs us with change so vast and powerful that all we can do is endure as the current carries us to a world we may not recognize. These days, we often hear people say, I no longer recognize my world. Let's see what I'm doing here. Okay. He then goes on to say, can our practice open us to the point where we risk learning new ways to live? How do we open ourselves to risk? You must open wider than you can imagine, according to Zen Master Ma Zhou. Layman Pang asked great teacher Ma Zhou, who is the man who doesn't accompany the 10,000 dharmas? Teacher Ma replied, layman, wait until you've swallowed in one swig all of the water of the West River, then I'll tell you. Mm-hmm. This is our practice. There's no edge to don't know, no frame in which we can comfortably nestle what concerns us. There is simply this world, this life, an ocean in which everything swims. Within this open frame, we watch each thing arise and disappear. What is it that arises, perhaps again and again? And what disappears? What do we dwell on? Who is asking? Consider a Zen student near the end of Tang Dynasty in China, when the Emperor Wuzong, citing corruption and excessive wealth, ordered the burning of 4,600 Buddhist temples and 40,000 hermitages, along with forcibly returning more than 250,000 monks and nuns to lay life. A few surviving teachers fled to the mountains with a handful of followers. What would it be like to practice Zen with all the temples and hermitages burning around you? Or consider a shepherd 9,000 years ago in the savanna that eventually became the floor of the Black Sea. The rising Mediterranean Sea came rushing up and over the Bosporus in a giant waterfall larger than the Amazon River. It made a lake that chased everyone away as its shoreline advanced outward 2 kilometers each day, creating the early Black Sea in only 300 days. As if an ocean could strike like lightning. Every culture surrounding the Black Sea is founded on the myth of the Great Flood, so the shock echoes to this day all over the world. If we persevere and keep watching amid all the forms and dharmas that arise, we arrive at the root from which all these things grow. Mind makes everything. Modern psychology has converged on this ancient Zen teaching. Current inquiry indicates that one of our brain's main function is as a prediction engine. From moment to moment, the brain predicts what will challenge us next, and to help us meet that challenge, it generates feelings, emotions, thoughts, and ideas. It's like a fountain creating the universe again and again, from microsecond to microsecond, faster than we can consciously think. Seeing this process frees us from the trap of inside and outside, wherein all feelings and sensations arise from impacts from what lies outside of us. There is no outside. Each one of us is the author of our whole story. If we can own this great responsibility, then the flak doesn't keep us from what we need to do. We know the flak. We wrote it. So I just did a few little snippets from that essay. It's quite a good essay. Very useful. Now, I'd like to return to the queer community in my own experience. Those of us who have come out, whether as gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, or any of the other ways that don't conform to what's so-called normal, have had to confront the realization that what we always thought was true turns out not to be so. Everything is called into question. We find that the new ways of looking at the world, no matter how unfamiliar, make more sense. And so we embrace the new paradigm, eventually, or maybe suddenly. This process is not always easy or quick. For myself, I observe that much of my work is internal, hidden to a greater or lesser extent from easy view. There may be glimpses of what's going on under the surface, but the result of the process often comes out in a sudden burst of light. Oh, this is what I need to do now. This is the way things work now. This changes everything. From the outside, it sometimes looks sudden and impulsive, but I know that it's not, and I've learned to trust the process. When I feel stuck, when things start to feel constrained, when difficulties and anomalies arise and things aren't working the way I think they should, I try to remember that process is always happening. Things will change. I can be afraid of that, or I can embrace it freely, but a change happens regardless. My response to it can allow me to navigate the process with grace, or it can put me up against reality in a way that creates more suffering, both for myself and those around me. We all have to find our way through these times. We support each other in many ways, but each of us has to do the actual work of navigating our own life. Our practice is to sit down, let thoughts and feelings settle. Notice what's going on in the body and mind. Let go of thoughts, ideas, and concepts. Stay with what's happening right now. Allow a different form of wisdom and knowing to arise, a way that's difficult or sometimes impossible to put into words. So we study Buddhist teachings, especially the precepts or ethical guidelines, to guide us in going about the world. We bring our practice of meditation to everything that happens, which allows us to see more clearly what is true. This can give rise to a wiser response to the conditions that surround us. It can give us important tools for navigating the paradigm shifts that arise in a wholesome and graceful way. And that's my talk. Comments and questions, welcome. Go ahead.
If now is the time for questions. If you have a question, you can go, and you're in the room, you can go ahead and raise your hand, and I'll bring the mic to you. And if you are on Zoom, the host will go ahead and put your question in the chat or request to be unmuted, and the host will unmute you. Oh, and please say your name.
This is Andy. Thank you for that great talk. Do you differentiate between a paradigm and a framework within which to hold different paradigms? Let me give you an example that I think of, but I want to see if the scientific method is like a framework. It's a process by which you have a hypothesis, you test it, does it meet or not, and you go on. Different paradigms of viewing the world can arise from within the scientific method.
Right.
Relativity or Newtonian physics or different things, right?
Right.
And I see Buddhism as sort of a framework sometimes within which different paradigms can arise. Can you comment on that?
Buddhism is actually pretty similar to the scientific method. That's
one of the reasons I love it.
Yes. It's instead of being a belief system, and I point this out all the time, especially to new people, This is not a belief system, but it is a practice of inquiry, which is exactly what you're talking about. And in that sense, it's very scientific. That's one of the things I really value about Buddhism. So I guess I wouldn't call that a paradigm. I would call that more of, this is how we do stuff. It might be a method, it might be a practice, however you want to call that. Yeah, frameworks works too, I guess.
Thank you.
Hi, on Zoom, this is Tony. I have a question.
Yes.
Since you brought up Kuhn, I think one of the things that he underplays in that whole argument is that when one of these changes comes along, you don't just throw out the old thing, because after all, the old thing worked. It worked perfectly well until the anomaly came along.
Right.
I think that tends to get forgotten in this sort of political rush of changing things.
Uh-huh.
And the sort of the discrepancy between young and old can very much be a part of that. I think if everyone could take a breath and say, well, instead of just dissing the past completely,
right,
say, it worked fine. What worked about it? What came along that changed our point of view? Because that's the way science works. You never, ever throw out the old. You reconcile with the old, because the old worked as long as it worked.
One of the things that I remember thinking during this whole process was Kilgan used to talk about the difference between Newtonian physics and Einsteinian physics, and the difference between, like, thinking about gravity. Now, gravity works just fine, and that's, you know, in the relative world, that's mostly what we're doing. We're dealing with Newtonian physics. But the theory of relativity, oddly enough, is actually more like, it corresponds somewhat to the Buddhist concept of the relative and the absolute. Both are there, both are true, but they are different aspects of each other. I like to think of them as the front and the back of a hand, or a leaf, or anything like that. It's all part of the same thing, but it's just sort of how you look at it is a little different. And he does mention that in here, that he's, I haven't read the whole book, by the way, I just have to say that. I managed to get through some of it and thought, okay, I get the gist, and then he's getting like way down into the weeds. But he does mention that it's not a matter of saying that there's something wrong with the past. Even if we say that was incorrect or that was an incomplete understanding of what we thought we knew, it's a matter of like, oh, okay, but now here's a different way to look at it that's actually maybe more beneficial, or there's a benefit to it. There's something that is going to make things better or more clear or something like that.
I think the only word I would take exception to in that is incorrect. Because, for example, in science, I know it's different in the world, not necessarily, but in science, work very, very hard to make sure that what you're believing, if I can use that word, is correct. Right? It doesn't become incorrect. It becomes inapplicable in terms of your wider point of view, but it never becomes incorrect.
Yes, I think that's true, and you're right. I worried about that word when I said it. But if you think about the, he talks about the myth of the flood. Okay, that's a myth, but that doesn't mean there's anything wrong with it. In fact, there's a lot of truth to it, right, in that particular situation. So,
all right, thank you.
We had a couple over here.
Thank you. Am I on?
Yes, you are. I can hear you.
Thank you for the talk, Ginkgo. I'm doing some discerning in my life, and during the Prajna Paramita Sutra, I was feeling this open-hearted willingness, and I felt inspired to put my hands out like this on my lap to be open and receptive to whatever wants to be. But I felt a gentle kind of nudge and to put my hands back in the mudra. And the sense was like, no, that's the form.
Uh-huh.
And I felt a kind of smile and affirmation in that, in terms of like, yes, it can be totally blown open, you know, and anything is possible. Mm-hmm. But there's a deep respect for what has been, who I've been, what I've been through, and so that is held in this loving awareness, but there's this spaciousness nevertheless through that point, and that felt a little more like the way to proceed.
So that's interesting. Because when I think about the mudra that we use when we're sitting, there is actually open space there. So I don't know that there's a huge difference between this and this. It may be that they look a little different, but and the form that sometimes seems like it's restrictive or constraining has a sense of openness and spaciousness to it as well. It's a question of, I suppose, how you're looking at it, you know, how you're experiencing it. So there's times when we say that it is appropriate to put down the forms. We talk about sometimes summer practice, which isn't that different these days, but it used to be really different, that when you go on vacation, you can put all of it down and begin to see what happens when you put down the forms, and how does it feel, and to what extent is the form still operating with you and through you, right? So it's a different way to experience it.
Thank you for your talk. My name is Guy. I am wondering if there's something bad about, I don't know, maybe I felt a twinge of resistance when you described the changing of the gods, because to me that sounds like a story about imperialist violence, and really sticks in my craw, this man in Hawaii, his kahuna, is saying, okay, well, I kind of give in because you guys won. I mean, I don't think that's right somehow.
Well, it is a complex story, and Michener, of course, is a white man, and I come from white privilege as well. My feeling about it back then was actually less judgmental and more just like, huh, isn't that interesting how that happened? And I don't think Michener pulls punches about the damage that it did or, the problems with it. My sense is that he was fairly even-handed about it. I might go back and reread it now and feel different about it. But the fact is, shit happens. And then we can't always do anything about it. And I think what I admired about Kalolo is, and he wasn't perfect by any means, he was doing a bunch of other bad shit that I didn't even get into. But he recognized the fact that this is how it is. Now, what do we do with this? How do we navigate this? And, you can say things are bad or I don't know, all kinds of stuff. You can say things about that. And that may even be true. I mean, climate change, and what are you going to do? I mean, we have all this stuff going on, a lot of political stuff around it. And yet, what we're dealing with is what's happening right now. And how do we work with that? We can't necessarily control how it's all going to come out. All we can do is look at what's happening and do our very best to have a wise response to it. And that's what I was admiring with Kalolo. I was like, I don't necessarily agree that somebody should come in and change everything, but that's how it works.
Right. Yeah. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Julia. What I was struck with here is the moment that the stone is placed, it's almost like the old gods don't go away. Because the stone is placed down, and he's like, all right, nah, that's not where that should go. And then from an interpretation of that is the gods level that building several times.
Right.
Before it's assembled in the correct way.
Right.
And what was the person's name who said that that's not where the stone should go?
Kalolo.
Kalolo was like reaching to a place within themselves.
Right.
To like transmute the wisdom of not putting the stone there.
Mm-hmm.
And so often that's what I see when looking around is like, this is like, I suppose a God that does not change, is that there is a place that has a wisdom that cannot be ignored.
And I think that's part of what Tony was getting at. It doesn't go away. It's no longer wrong. So when you say the gods are changing, that doesn't mean the old gods are now dead and they are going away. If you go to Hawaii, you will find quite a few people who will say, oh yeah, I speak to Pele all the time, you know, or whatever. I mean, those gods are still around. So it's not a question of that, but I think what he's saying and the way I'm thinking of it, the way I'm looking at it is that the cultural conditions that we're living under have changed, and we have to deal with that.
I suppose my question that was attached to that was, how does the practice of Zen connect one, or does it, to that wisdom?
Huh. You know, I think when we learn to be open to things as they are right now, and we learn to be open to the fact that not everything can be described in the terms that we know, can allow for things that are maybe mysterious, impossible, greater than anything we can know, that we can then touch those places. We can find the spirit of the land.
Thank you.
Hey, this is Tony again, I'm sorry. Just adding to what you just said, I think Zazen is all about getting behind what I know. Any particular sort of what I know, right? I mean, Uchiyama goes on quite a lot about Zazen can seem unsatisfactory because it always feels incomplete because it's not directed at the knowing mind. Yet something is happening.
Right. Mm-hmm. It looks like nothing, and yet there's something going on. It's yeah. True.
Hi, my name is Grant. I'm just interested to hear your thoughts on why some traditions last and why some fall to history.
That's a great question. I wish I had an answer to that, because I don't. It seems that there are there's an arc of how this kind of stuff works. I would guess, this is speculation on my part, I would guess that religions that last, if you look at the world religions that have been around for a long time, there's a flexibility to them. Buddhism, very much like Christianity, has different forms in different places. It goes into different cultures, it takes on aspects of that culture. It finds a way to translate what the teachings are to what people of a particular culture can do. So we're always kind of reinterpreting and retranslating what's going on. You see that definitely Christianity has so many different forms around the world, and that's part of what keeps it alive. And I think that with Buddhism, we're also keeping it alive by our practice and by our ways of exploring it. I think Judaism, you could say the same thing. Yes, there are aspects of Judaism, particularly certain cults of it and whatever, that look from the outside like they're being very, very conservative and hanging on to a particular set of practices. If you go into the, if you go inside of it and start paying attention, you'll begin to realize, no, there is something vital going on there. There is some way that this is why this practice works for me, right? And I think that may be what keeps a religion going, is that ability to reconfigure, to reimagine, not to give up the old, but to find a different way of expressing it, perhaps.
Thank you.
This is Dinah.
Next time.
It would seem that in a lot of paradigm shifts, things like plate tectonics or climate change or even, you know, transgender and all the different things, there's once there's a push, there's the, sort of the counter-revolution, and where the establishment is defending their turf, and it, mm-hmm. you know, and the change can come quickly, or it can be years, and then suddenly you have a push back. I mean, that's kind of some of the things we're seeing today. So I was wondering, with that as a model, what is the, in terms of our Zen practice, what is the, I guess, warning, or how do we guard against that in ourselves, and how do we identify it? Mm.
So that kind of gets into that sense of wanting things to get back to normal, or the way they were, because of somehow that was better than, you know, what's happening now. And that is a kind of a common way of thinking, but one of the things that we learn if we're paying attention is there's no such thing as back to normal. There's only moving forward from here. And that thought that somehow things used to be better and that's what we want to get back to, or that things are perfect right now, this is actually a second noble truth now that I think about it. You know, the second noble truth is, here's what causes suffering. We're either hanging on to things the way they are, we want to keep them the way they are, or we're pushing away the things we don't want, right? And that is just, that is the cause of suffering. So there's the Buddhist teaching for you right there. Came up right at the beginning.
Okay, on Zoom, Oren has a question.
Hi, Dean. So you're talking about the whole history of art here, of course, assimilating the gods of the other cultures. Apollo as Jesus is one example. Either take the powerful or to make them small, like in Ireland. The gods, the powerful gods, become little tiny fairies and leprechauns. But what I really want to say is I experienced a major tectonic shift in my personal philosophy this week with the discovery that at the moment of conception, we are a burst of light. That is the moment of conception, that we are built of light and not matter. That just blows my mind. And I'm just wondering if that's going to have any expression in our own culture. So that's just a comment, not really a question.
I'm not quite sure I understand your expression. I'm having a little trouble understanding, you know, what you're saying anyway, just in terms of knowing what the words are that you're saying, but I'm not quite sure I understand what your question is.
Well, there was a video that was released in Monday's news that shows a sperm penetrating an egg, and it produces this burst of light. And then the egg, the whole thing lights up like a halo, that we're not, our first moment is not matter, but light. That expresses every spiritual discipline I know of.
Yeah, well, the thing is about all of that, though, is it, you can say that's the beginning, but the fact is, it's also the ending of something, and it comes from something else. So what we have is basically flow and process. And so, yeah, there's moments when there's like this big shift, right? And suddenly it's like, oh, now we're going this way, and this is what's happening, and it's big and huge and wonderful and exciting. And then there's like, okay, now we're going to get down to the nitty-gritty of doing the day-to-day work. All of it is big and exciting and wonderful. So it may look like, it's like graduation, graduating from high school. They call it commencement. That means we're starting out now. And at the same time, we're finishing something. We're finishing something, and then we're doing something else. That's a shift. That's a big shift. And we're losing something, and now we're going forward and doing something different. So that happens over and over and over in all kinds of ways in our lives.
Absolutely. Absolutely true. It's just, for me, it's finally having something positive reflect on, you know, in our time.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you for your talk.
Maybe two more here and here. Okay.
I'm glad I stayed for your talk. I wasn't going to stay for your talk, but I'm glad I did stay for your talk. The longer I practice, the bigger, the wider, the more wondrous, and the more mysterious it all gets.
Yeah.
It's just amazing.
It is.
And some paradigm shifts I like,
uh-huh.
Some I don't like,
uh-huh.
Some I relate to, some I don't relate to, some I think are evolving at a reasonable pace, some are going too fast or too slow for me. And when I find myself stewing about all that, I remind myself those are just thoughts, ideas, and views.
Yep.
They don't make them right. Maybe they're true, maybe they're not. And if I err in any direction, I want to live today, and I want to be on the ride going forward.
Here,
and
here.
I credit my this practice for that.
Yeah.
And I just can't wait.
Except that waiting is part of it.
I know, but I can't wait.
Yeah, no, it's all great. I agree.
Okay, on Zoom, Suzette has a comment. He says, thank you for your talk. Encourages, quote, scholar practitioner, unquote.
Yes.
When first introduced, I equated non-binary from my framework as androgyny, as you mentioned, but I needed some direct practice with it. I found that an experiential meditation on trying to find gender in the present helpful for me. One iteration is, where is gender now? It was more than just intellectually helpful as a being.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Good.
Hello, this is Dayo. Thank you for your talk. I was really moved by the anecdote in the beginning, this little story, and I've been reflecting on why that is over the course of the question and answer, because ostensibly it's like, this, like, the kahuna, who seems like pretty cool, who I want to root for, like, has lost something, and like it makes, and in this context it feels like change is being characterized as this like white oppressive force of nature, mm-hmm. right, which is pretty easily categorized in my brain as bad.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just I don't know. Like, I, relating it to my life, I guess what I see is he's not like resisting, and he's also not just like being bowled over and
exactly.
like resigned to his circumstances.
Right.
And like, I think that's hard for me. My, the nuance of that is hard for me.
Yeah.
My girlfriend tells me I'm too quick to accept my fate. and I want to, but that's because like I really don't want to resist fate.
Yeah.
But I think keeping that third option, keeping the agency alive.
That's a good way to put it, a third option, yeah.
And going for something beautiful
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and graceful. But so, how do I, like, do that better?
Well, poof, you got it now. when we say non-opposition or acceptance, we don't mean passivity. It's harder to say what we do mean by that. So it has something to do with understanding that the gods are not dead, that they still are alive, they still have agency, even though they're changing and our relationship to them is changing. Where I come up with this one a lot is, how do I deal with political protests? I really have a hard time with political protests because they seem very oppositional. And to a large extent, they end up being that way. I have to say that the No Kings thing that I went to in October didn't feel oppositional, even though it says no right there as in the title, No Kings. But it wasn't only about opposition. It was about what is it that we want? Who are we as people? What is the culture we are wanting to promote? And you got it with frogs and with, you know, drum circles, and you got it with all these sort of whimsical, crazy things, and you also got it with very earnest speeches, and you got all kinds of things, and with however many thousands of people there were. And it felt much more positive than a lot of the protests that I've been to, which have been just like, you know, opposition. There is a way to do that. I'm convinced there's a way to do that. And there's a way to do it in my own life as well. It's like, I don't have to accept something that is abusive or belittling or whatever that is. I don't have to accept that for myself. I may or may not overtly challenge it, but certainly within myself, I can challenge that and say, wait a minute, that's not true for me. And then figure out, where do I go with that from here? I don't know if that helps.
No, but it's nice.
Best I can do at the moment. Okay. I think we're there. Thank you all for your kind attention.